Blog Talk Radio.
Dubin, talk about the NFL, talk about the NBA. He works for about six entities. We'll get to all that in a minute. Talk about Super Bowl 50, which was won in dominating defensive fashion by the Denver Broncos. We start, though, with golf. We start, though, with what happened yesterday with Ricky Fowler and Hideki Matsuyama. And there's been a raging debate ever since regulation happened with what should Ricky Fowler have done. He hit driver, took a really freak bounce off that downslope. Should he have gone 3 wood? Should he have gone iron on the tee? It's been a raging debate on Twitter, on social media, on the broadcast. He's now hit it in that water 9 times at 17 at the Waste Management Phoenix Open yesterday, which was won by Hideki Matsuyama after he hits it in the water for the second time. I did a Twitter poll today. What should Ricky Fowler have hit in regulation? Driver, 3 wood, or an iron of some kind? Driver, 35%. 3 wood, 42%. Iron, 23%. As you can see, and that's 26 votes, obviously. So it's not a large number, but you can still see. It's not like a huge swath of people suddenly said, let's do this or let's do that. So it's interesting to look at it in that light because there's not a clear-cut answer among the golfing public. So I asked DJ Pyhowski from the PGA Tour, who has access to the ShotLink numbers, to look it up. Did anybody lay way, way, way back, give themselves 100 yards, go for the green, hit it to 35 feet, whatever? The answer, nobody. There were 3 balls in the right bunker, far up, probably 35, 40 yards from the green. But nobody laid back. Nobody hit in that bunker in the middle of the fairway. A couple of guys, there's a bunch of guys, probably 12 or 13 guys, short, right, by anywhere between just off to back to about 25, 30 yards. But those guys probably had it spin back, a ton up short. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, 8 balls in the water left. Two of those guys made par, one just short. One in the back bunker who made bogey, one just over the green who made par. This graphic does not show just beyond the green where Ricky is, but the birdies and the two eagles all came from short. One got out of that bunker on the right, but all came from short or just on. It's an interesting snapshot. In that we always talk about, laying up versus going for it. What do the percentages say? What's the smart move, so to speak? And as you can see, everybody thought that on 17 yesterday, which played 317, scorecard yardage of 332, but played 317. Nobody laid it up short. Ricky Fowler ends up in tears, wanted to win in front of his family, including his grandfather and his father. His father had never seen him win an event before, and Hideki Matsuyama gets another PGA Tour win to add to his growing resume, along with the memorial and a couple trips on the President's Cup team. Actually, I think that was his first President's Cup appearance. It'll be the first of many for Hideki. We are going to take a timeout, come back in 30 seconds, and talk to Jared Dubin. This is Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling on Blog Talk Radio, the Golf News Net Radio Network, and iTunes. Stay with us. Back in 30 seconds.
Sometimes tough isn't enough. Lou Gehrig was baseball's Iron Man, but lost it all to ALS, a muscle-wasting disease that destroyed his skills and ended his life in just a few years. MDA has been leading the fight to vanquish ALS for decades. Truly effective treatments must be found, because the battle Lou Gehrig fought is still being waged in households across America. call 1-800-572-1717 to learn more about what MDA is doing to strike out ALS and save lives.
We are back on Teeing It Up for Jeremy Schilling. We will be joined momentarily by Jared Dubin, who is as good an X's and O's guy as you will find. And he writes for CBS Sports, Sports Illustrated, Vice, The Calls Room, which is now part of the Sports Illustrated family, and Bleacher Report. We welcome in Jared Dubin. Hello, sir.
Hey, man. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I was going to start this with football, but after the Knicks fired Derek Fisher, I think we have to start there. First of all, how surprised were you of this decision?
I was pretty surprised. You know, this was a team that shouldn't have been very good this year anyway. You know, they won 17 games last season, and typically a 17-win team wins an average of about 27 games the following season, and they're already bumping up pretty close to that. So it's hard to say that they haven't, you know, met or even exceeded expectations for what they should have been this year. Obviously, they're not playing all that well lately, having lost 9 of 10, but I thought the fact that Fisher was Phil's quote-unquote guy and the fact that they weren't expected to be good this year to begin with was going to get them a little bit more leeway, and obviously that didn't happen.
You're an X's and O's guy. You love looking at it from that angle. Was there anything schematically that Fisher was doing that you think may have led to this, or was this just a need for a change?
I'm not sure. Phil did say something about, you know, it being not imperative but important. I can't remember what the exact quote was. That, you know, whoever coaches the team adheres to the triangle offense. The Knicks, you know, that was their base offense, but they did make some tweaks to it this season. And, you know, in recent games had begun moving away from it altogether in the second half of games when they were down by a bunch. And as they tried to come back, they would go to more of the spread, pick, and roll type stuff that you see across the NBA. That stuff tended to work better than their mechanical triangle offense stuff did. So I can't necessarily see why the moves away from it would lead Phil to make this decision, but he is someone that staunchly adheres to that system, not just as a basketball philosophy, but he's even referred to it in the book as like a life philosophy somehow in a roundabout way. So, you know, maybe it was those little tweaks, but I would think that, you know, less so offensively, the fact that they haven't really improved that much on defense, especially as their opponent's three-point percentage has crept up throughout the season, where they were getting a little bit lucky on that in the early part of the year. I think that, you know, plays more into the fact that the team hasn't been quite as good lately as they were early in the year, and that may be, you know, the schematic thing that forced Phil to make the move.
You mentioned Phil wanting to stay with the triangle. The first two candidates, and I forget who put this out there, but the first two leading candidates I saw were Brian Shaw and Luke Walton. Do you think this limits the pool? A lot of people want Tom Thibodeau. Do you think this limits the pool of candidates, and should Phil have more of an open mind?
To answer the final two questions, I think, yes, it limits the pool of candidates, and yes, he should have more of an open mind, but I don't necessarily know if he will. You know, you look at the initial coaching search he did, and he basically only looked at coaches that had some sort of connection to him as a coach, and whether they coached under him in Chicago or L.A. or played for him in Chicago or L.A. You know, it was Derek Fisher and Steve Kerr and Luke Walton and Jim Clemens and Kurt Rambis. Brian Shaw wasn't really on the list because the Knicks would have had to give up draft picks compensation to even talk to him because he was under contract with the Nuggets at the time. You know, I would expect it'll be a similar list the next time they go shopping for a coach. You know, Tom Thibodeau, I think, is clearly the best coach available on the market, but I would be very surprised if Phil wound up hiring him just because, you know, he's mentioned that he wants someone that A, runs the triangle, and B, has some sort of connection to him you know, whether it's from his coaching days or his playing days, and Thibodeau doesn't have that.
Talking with Jared Dubin here on Teeing Up about basketball and eventually football. Let's talk about the team. They're slumping. You kind of mentioned this before. How much of Carmelo's issues do you think plays into the slump, or is there something bigger than just Carmelo's sore knee?
That is tough to say. You know, they're, I think, 0-7 without Carmelo in the lineup this year, and that's basically all of the margin under 500 that they are. And they've been, you know, either tied or with the lead in the fourth quarter in six of those seven games. So it's not as though they're just getting blown off the floor every time when Carmelo is out. But the fact that he's not shooting as well as he did in the past, particularly late in games, obviously has not helped them. You know, not having a consistent secondary scorer is something that's been an issue since Carmelo got to the team. You know, they do have a few different options in Aaron Aflalo and Kristaps Porzingis, obviously, but neither one of them is the most consistent scorer. You know, Aflalo has been one of the most inconsistent players in the league for a few years, and Porzingis is still a rookie. You know, he'll have his big games, and he'll have his games where he doesn't do all that much. I think that might be, you know, a little bit more playing into the quote-unquote slump that, to me, is more just regression to the mean than people realize initially.
You mentioned Porzingis. He came on start the season. Porzingis Mania, Godzingis, KP, all these nicknames being thrown around. Do you think some of his recent struggles have to do with teams having more film on him and being able to adapt better to him, or is he going through rookie struggles?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, everybody, eventually, they get film on you, and you have to learn how to make adjustments, you know, particularly when it's your first go-round through the league ever, and particularly when you're coming from Europe as opposed to college, where guys don't get to watch you quite as much. You're going to shock some people with the things you can do, especially with the way he was playing early on in the year. You know, now that people have film, teams know, like, you can't possibly let him get a free run at the basket on a jumper. You can't let him come in to get one of those tip dunks. They know the different moves that he likes to try in the post, and that they can bring, you know, a hard double team when he puts the ball down on the floor, because, you know, while he has good passing vision, he's not necessarily good at passing off the dribble. So they know these things that they can trick him into a little, not necessarily trick him into, but they can get into his skill set a little bit by baiting him into going certain places on the floor and doing certain things where they can then react a certain way. And then now it's up to him to make adjustments to that. He's done that in some games. He's not done that in others. And that, I think, is the part that, you know, he's still a rookie. You know, you're not going to make the perfect adjustments to what the defense shows you every game. You know, if you did, you'd be LeBron James or Steph Curry.
Talking with Jared Dubin here, excuse me, on Teeing It Up. You mentioned Steph. He obviously did not have a great day yesterday. His keep pounding drum beat didn't help the Panthers to victory. People say that he somehow got better from last season. He looks stronger to me, you know, as a layman. From an X's and O's perspective, what exactly has Steph done to get better? Because he had a wild off season, and it seemed like he somehow found the time to improve. Where did that improvement happen?
I think it's from the two most important areas of the floor as an offensive player. It's from in close and from deep. He's finishing better at the rim, and he's pulling up, you know, willing to pull the trigger from even deeper on his shots than he was before. You know, it's not an unusual sight at all to see him pull up from 28 feet, 30 feet from the basket. I saw some stat earlier in the season on shots from like 20 feet away. He had the same amount of, 28 plus feet away. At one point, maybe a month or so ago, he had the same amount of makes on those kind of shots as almost the rest of the league. Like, it's absolutely insane how deep he's willing to pull up from sometimes. And when you can score, basically when you walk over half court, you're impossible to guard. And the fact that he's willing to give up the ball when teams do blitz him and set Draymond Green up for that 4-on-3 from the top of the three-point line down, you know, working against three defenders with himself and two shooters and a lob man at the rim. There's just no way to defend that, especially when Draymond is making the right decision with the ball almost every time.
This may sound like a silly question, but we see Steph every day, every game, take those half-court shots, take that shot from the tunnel. And I think, you know, for some people to show, obviously you want to practice half-court buzzer beaters because those do come up in a game. But do you think those shots have actually helped on his longer-range threes just because he's hitting so many of those shots per day?
I mean, you watch him in warm-ups. He'll take shots from the logo like it's nothing. You know, it doesn't change his form at all, doesn't put any extra oomph into it. It's exactly the same. You know, obviously half-court or from the tunnel is a little bit of a trick shot. It's all part of the show. But him pulling up from 30, 35 feet, like, he can do that. He's that good of a shooter from literally anywhere as soon as he steps over half court.
One last thing on Steph. You're somebody who has played. You know how important being strong is. But I think a lot of people look at Steph, and the reason why he's so popular is he's not some big ripped guy. He's not some 6'2", you know, 210 guy. He's a lanky, short guy who has made a heck of a career out of what some would perceive as a weakness. How important for him is getting stronger going forward?
I think he already has gotten stronger. I think, you know, more important than necessarily adding bulk or weight for him is, you know, being able to maintain his balance and his agility. You know, that's such a key to the way he operates in the pick and roll, whether it's to get off his jumper or to drive the paint. And just to move side to side and be able to see all the different angles that he sees on the court, that to me is more important than, you know, having to be some arbitrary number like 220 pounds or whatever it is. His body type is his body type. You know, he's not going to all of a sudden become a guy that's built like Russell Westbrook. You know, that's just not going to happen, and it wouldn't help him if it did. For me, the things that he's been working on these last few years are the things that he should continue to work on because that's what's worked for him.
Two-part question. First part's a very simple question. How the heck are the Warriors this good? And B, did you ever see this coming? As somebody who looks at the X's and O's every time you watch a game, are you stunned by what you're seeing?
Well, I would say the first question is sort of the opposite of simple. You know, it's been a long, painstaking process to get them to where they are. It involved nailing a whole bunch of different draft picks with Steph, with Harrison Barnes, with Draymond Green, with Festus Ezeli. They had to win a few different trades, getting Andrew Bogut, getting Andre Iguodala in a sign-and-trade. They added different guys in free agency like Sean Livingston and Leandro Barbosa, even somebody like Maurice Spates, who doesn't play as big of a role as some of those other guys do, but is a valuable, you know, 10, 15-minute guy off the bench when he does get in the game. They made a very difficult coaching change after somebody who, you know, won 50-plus games with their team. They decided to move on from him, even though the players liked him a lot. And they hired someone else who brought in and installed an entirely new offensive system that was able to take more advantage of, you know, the gifts of the guys on their team. And then even after doing all that, they had to look into David Lee getting hurt last preseason to discover that, you know, Draymond Green was someone that could change games all by himself. So, you know, although the pieces always seemed like they should fit together better than they did under Mark Jackson, especially on offense, I don't think it was necessarily obvious that they were ever going to be this good. I mean, this is unheard of what they're doing. There's been one team ever that has won 70-plus games in a season, and they're on pace to destroy that record right now. I don't think anyone that tells you that they saw this to this extent coming is telling the truth.
Talking with Jared Dubin, let's switch to football here. I was one of those people who, when somebody would say that the Panthers would win big, I never bought it. I saw what that Denver defense did during the AFC Championship game, and I said, there's no way that this will be a blowout. I, though, never saw this Bronco defense being as hardened, as tough as they were yesterday. In golf, we see all the time young guys, first time in a big spot, major championship Sunday, they show the nerves, they show the inexperience, they go backwards. How much of yesterday do you think was the inexperience of the Panthers, and how much was the Bronco defense just being sensational?
I think it was a lot more of the latter than the former. You know, coming into the season, everybody thought the Panthers basically had two main weaknesses. The first one was that they didn't have any weapons, especially once Kelvin Benjamin went down. And if you could scheme Greg Olsen out of the game, then you could make them into a one-dimensional offense. We saw that happen yesterday for sure. The second big weakness was that their offensive tackles were, let's just say, they left a lot to be desired in the talent department. And, you know, that was probably the single biggest key to the game yesterday, was that Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware absolutely dominated Mike Remmers and Michael Orr. I mean, the combined, they had, I think, 5.5 sacks or 4.5 sacks between the two of them, you know, 2.5 for Miller and 4 and 2 for Ware. And obviously the two biggest plays of the game were Miller strip sacking Cam Newton. So I think it was more than anything, it was the Panthers' two biggest weaknesses coming back to bite them at the worst possible time.
Yeah, bad timing and in a bad spot. You know, you're somebody, and I think you've talked about this on the show, and I know, having known you forever, you got fiery at times in your career. You let the emotion show publicly. You lived how you felt inside. Cam obviously not talking to the media much after and then walking out. What was your take on that? Because you're somebody that lived an emotional game yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I was also a kid, so I think it was a little bit different.
Very fair.
You know, there are expectations placed on professional athletes that aren't necessarily fair, you know. To have somebody, you know, 20 minutes after they just lost the biggest game of their life and didn't play especially well, to have to sit and face a group of, you know, hundreds of people nitpicking every single thing that went wrong for them and asking some frankly ridiculous questions. You know, I wrote about it this morning. You look at the questions Cam was asked. Like, he was asked the same question twice, about three different questions in that post-game interview. He was asked two questions that weren't questions at all. And he was asked one question where somebody basically asked him to write their story for him. Like, the man or woman, I'm not sure who it was because the transcript was just the transcript, said, like, can you put your disappointment into words? Like, that's just asking Cam Newton to write your story for you. So the things he was being asked, it's not like he walked out of there having left, you know, a bunch of burning questions on the table. There's fault on both sides, I think. You know, maybe he should have conducted himself a little more, I don't even know what the word is. You know, don't sulk and pout and talk in a whisper voice the whole time, you know, so people don't get mad. But also, like, why does he have to live up to people's expectations for what they claim they would do in a post-game interview that they're never actually going to do? You know, the guy just lost the biggest game of his life. It's understandable that he doesn't necessarily want to answer inane questions like that in the most engaging way. That's sort of a roundabout way of saying I don't really care what Cam Newton did in his post-game interview, and I think it's silly that people really seem to care so much, but that's sort of a lukewarm take, so I had to work my way up to it.
Let's flip back to the NBA here. Cavs fired David Blatt. I think a lot of people may have been surprised on the exact timing, but weren't overall surprised to see this fate happen. From an X's and O's standpoint, what do the Cavs have to do? And obviously things have improved a bit since the firing, but we saw the beatdown that Golden State gave them. What do the Cavs have to do to get better and get back to that level where they can be competitive with the Spurs or competitive with Golden State.
Well, here's the thing. Like, the Cavs are really good. In most normal years, they'd be the best or second best team in the league. But this isn't a normal year. You know, like I said before, there's been one team ever that won 70-plus games, and as recently as like a week and a half ago before Tim Duncan got hurt, we had two teams on place to do it. You know, they're talking about playing with two all-time great teams, like in the handful, four, five, six best teams in the history of basketball. You know, there's no shame in not necessarily being able to keep up with those teams. This Warriors team is better than the one that they kept up with for a few games in the finals last year. And even then, they did it in sort of, I don't know how to describe what they did. It was, you know, they pulled a rabbit out of a hat, and it's a style that isn't necessarily compatible with having Kevin Love and or Kyrie Irving on the floor. It's not like you just say, oh, we're going to play defense as well as we did in the finals last year and add those guys, and our offense is much better. You know, a lot of the reason they were able to play defense that well was Kevin Love wasn't on the floor. He's very simply not a good pick-and-roll defender. Kyrie Irving is not a good defender. And when you run into the Spurs and Warriors, they're going to attack, hunt those weaknesses until you take one of those guys off the floor. Now, maybe they're willing to do that in the finals, maybe they're not. But until you figure out an adjustment or you remove them from the floor, teams that good are going to attack, and you're not going to be able to stop them.
Who comes out of the West? It's a top-heavy West. I think a lot of people would say, would describe it as that, between Golden State, San Antonio, Oklahoma City. Is there any way in your mind that the Thunder can upset either of those two teams?
Sure. I mean, all it takes is an injury, right? And it's not like they're not really good. They're on pace to win, you know, 60-plus games almost. It's a really good team. All it takes is an injury or Durant and Westbrook going nuts for 2 weeks. Anything can happen. Thing to happen? I don't think so. But I wouldn't put it past those guys.
If right now I said to you, I would like to bet a bunch of money, which I'm not going to do, but because I hate gambling. But who would you put your money on out of the East and the West to make it to the finals right now? Can Golden State keep this up, or is there a risk that they hit a wall from having this insane streak going for so long?
I don't see how you could talk yourself into anyone other than Cleveland in the East. You know, Toronto is probably the next best team there, but even then, I think Cleveland sort of walks through the Eastern Conference playoffs. In the West, I mean, you could say the Spurs, and I wouldn't necessarily argue with you, but I'm going with Golden State pretty much until further notice.
And final thing here, where does Peyton Manning rank for you in terms of the greatest of the great quarterbacks?
He's in the discussion, and I think that's really all that matters. You know, I don't think you necessarily need to pick, you know, who the best ever is. I can't really say with any level of truth anyway. You know, Joe Montana retired like 5 or 6 years into my life. I never saw guys like Johnny Unitas play. He is, you know, one of the best quarterbacks I've ever seen, and from all accounts, in the handful of best ever. And, you know, yesterday didn't change that one way or another. You know, one more win doesn't put him over the top of anybody else. If you didn't already think he was one of the best ever before he won yesterday, I don't really know what you were watching for the last 18, 19 years. He's incredible, always been incredible, and, you know, he's among the best of all time, and that's what he was worthy of, whether they won yesterday or whether they lost yesterday.
He is Jared Dubin. He writes for many places. The best way to find all his work is to follow him on Twitter at JADubin, DUBIN5, for coming on Teeing It Up, and great stuff, sir.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Have a good night.
Same to you. My pleasure. We'll see you next week here on Teeing It Up. See you, everybody.